Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure you go to the events page because we got an event, a regional event, you know, the National Here We Still Stand Conference, sold out long ago. I mean, it was sold out in a matter of 17 days, I believe, which is a record for us by a lot. It wasn't like it just like, ooh, a new record. It's like if the previous record for the 1 mile was 10 minutes and someone ran it in 25 seconds. It was that kind of record-breaking thing. So that one sold out. Can't go to that. But if you want to go to an event, you can come down to Bentonville, Arkansas, and come to the regional event. It's a two-day event, May 5th and 6th. Chad's going to be there. I'm going to be there. A whole bunch of other people are going to be there. It's a great time. It's only $99 for you to come hang out with us. I'll put a link in the show notes. But yeah, you should come hang out. We're going to be talking about the book of Galatians. Paul's letter to the Galatians is what we're going to be talking about the whole conference long. There's going to be great food, as always. There's going to be a concert on Friday night with the Arcadian Wild, who's a great four-piece kind of folky band out of Nashville, Tennessee. It's going to be a lot of fun. So check that out and see if you can't join us in the spring. Chad, last episode, God found himself a guy. He's been searching high. He's been searching low. He's been looking under every rock and seeing if he could find just somebody, anybody, that won't just, you know, pump the brakes on idolatry, but actually hit the gas and run over some Asherah poles, tear down some high places, you know, all of this sort of stuff. And lo and behold, last episode, we got to meet the guy that finally did what even good kings before him couldn't quite get done, and that is that the high places have been torn down. And this gets Hezekiah a gold star as far as kings of Israel go.
Yeah, he's the man. We've been kind of, I don't know how many times we've heard about the high places. So-and-so was a good king, but the high places remained. Well, the high places no longer remained under Hezekiah. So that opening eight verses of 2 Kings chapter 18 just sings the praises of Hezekiah. He not only tore down the high places, he got rid of the bronze serpent Nehushtan that had become an idolatrous object. None of the kings after him or those before him were quite as awesome as Hezekiah. He held fast to the Lord. The Lord was with him. He prospered. So on and so forth. And we wrapped up with verse 8, which describes another very David-like quality that Hezekiah has. He struck down the Philistines as far as Gaza and its territory from watchtower to fortified city. Now, one of the things that we're going to be talking actually quite a bit of in this episode is some overlap between what we read is happening in the biblical text about Hezekiah and the Assyrian kings that we're going to be hearing quite a bit about. We're also going to be talking about some material that we have from Assyrian records, in particular from those of Sennacherib. I'm going to try and kind of weave that into the biblical narrative because we actually know a lot about what is happening, what's being described in this chapter from other sources, from these Assyrian sources. And it's kind of cool to compare these two. And this is one of these instances where there's some overlap. So when we hear about him striking the Philistines down in Gaza and everywhere else, we know from the Assyrian records that, so one of the Philistine cities, Ekron, the king there had the name of Potti, and he had actually remained loyal to the Assyrians. But one of the things that happened is the Philistines didn't like the fact that he was loyal to the Assyrians, so they deposed him and carried him as a captive to Jerusalem. So during Hezekiah's reign, some of the Philistines in the city of Ekron actually carried their king as a prisoner and delivered him to Hezekiah, and he was there for some time as a captive in Jerusalem. So more than just striking down the Philistines, he actually ended up taking one of their kings back as a prisoner. Well, we shift from verse 8 to verses 9 through 12. And in those verses, we kind of have a recap of some of the stuff that we've talked about with the victories of the Assyrians. So in the fourth year of Hezekiah, that was the seventh year of Hoshea, who was the king in the northern kingdom. So during the fourth year of Hezekiah, Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came against Samaria, besieged it. At the end of 3 years, he took it. So we've talked about that back in chapter 17. This is the conquest of Samaria and thus the conquest of the northern kingdom. And then in the sixth year of Hezekiah, which was the ninth year of Hoshea, Samaria was taken. So Samaria is gone. The northern kingdom is going to be destroyed. And as we read on, the king of Assyria carried the Israelites captive to Assyria and put them all over the place. Put him in Halah, on the Habor, on the river of Gozan, in the cities of the Medes. Why? Because they did not, well, literally, they didn't listen to the voice of the Lord their God. Your English translations are going to render that obey. But they didn't listen, basically. They didn't shema. Instead, they listened to, well, they listened to the voice of false prophets. They listened to the voice of their own heads and hearts. They listened to the voice of their compatriots. But the one voice they didn't listen to was the voice of God. And instead, they transgressed his covenant. Even all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded, they neither listened nor obeyed.
They neither listened nor did, basically,
yeah. In Hebrew.
Yeah, I like this this last verse here. That they neither listened nor listened, which is really what's going on there. I mean, did. But the idea of listening is that you hear it, you absorb it, and that you may potentially act upon what it is that you've heard. And so not only did they not do anything or listen, they didn't listen or do anything. It's hard to do anything if you don't listen.
Yeah, right. Yeah, if you close your ears to the voice of the Lord, your God, you're not going to do, of course, what he says because you didn't hear. Yes. What he said for you to do.
This is one of the reasons that God is always like, listen to me. You got to listen to me. You got to listen to me. Because God knows that, you know how this goes when, I don't know, you have a kid and you're like, listen to me. Now, why are you doing that? Why don't you just say, do this thing? But why is it when your kids, you really need to tell him something and you need him to do something, you say, listen to the words that are coming out of my mouth because you know. As children are this way, and the children of God are no different, there's no chance that you do what it is that I desire you to do if you do not hear what I have to say. So I need you to listen very carefully.
That's why the ears are the organ of reception, right?
That's right.
Not the eyes.
That's
He's
right.
not saying, watch. He's saying, listen. So
when
open,
God says,
open
when
your
God
ears.
When God says, watch, He's about to do something.
Yeah, yeah. But he wants you to actually do something. He says, listen.
That's right.
I was thinking, that could be the epitaph on the tombstone of the northern kingdom. Those five words at the end of verse 12. They neither listened nor obeyed.
Yes.
That's not a happy epitaph, but that pretty much sums up everything. They didn't shema and they didn't asa. They didn't listen, and because of that, they didn't do. Period. That was their doom right there. So I think that we're pretty much done with the Northern Kingdom. That was just kind of a brief recap of what we talked about quite a bit back when we covered chapter 17. So now we're going to shift gears in verse 13, and we're going to hear a lot more about Hezekiah, and we're also going to hear quite a bit about his counterpart in Assyria. The next Assyrian ruler was a guy by the name of Sennacherib. So we're in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, and we have Sennacherib, who's the Assyrian king, who's decided that he's going to come up against all the fortified cities of Judah and besiege them and actually capture a number of them. So just kind of get ourselves oriented chronologically, this is 701 BC. So in case you're kind of wondering where we've been, that's a definite marker here, 701 BC. Sennacherib comes against Judah, and we not only have this recorded here, but we also have the same thing recorded in the book of Isaiah. So if you turn to Isaiah 36 through 39, a lot of the material that's recorded in 2 Kings is going to be also repeated almost verbatim, actually, in Isaiah 36 through 39. And of course, you have the Chronicles account as well. So this is one of those rare Old Testament instances where we have multiple occurrences of the same account described in pretty close sorts of ways, kind of a Matthew, Mark, Luke approach to this incident. And we know this. So what seems to have happened is, so Sennacherib becomes the ruler of Assyria, I think around maybe 706 BC. And is pretty typical when you have a turnover of leadership in the ancient world, what happens? We got revolts that are breaking out all over the place because the people who were under the authority of the previous ruler, they see this as a chance to, you know, to break bad, right? They're gonna rebel against the new ruler. They're gonna try and establish some independence again. So a lot of times the first few years of the new king is basically just squashing one rebellion after another. And we know that's what Sennacherib had to do. He had to squash rebellion against the Babylonians, and then he had the Philistines, he had the Egyptians, and then he had the people of Judea. All these people he had to take care of. Now, what's recorded for us here is how he moves into Judea and it begins to attack these various cities of Judah. And according to him, now this is according to the Assyrians, he captured, I think, 46 towns. Now, maybe he's exaggerating. There was a lot of exaggeration happening in this. This was Assyrian propaganda, keep in mind.
Yeah.
You know, so you can't read what the Assyrians wrote about these great accomplishments that they did without a grain of salt. Because, of course,
like,
they were...
It's like listening to the Russians tell you, we've lost 5 people in this entire battle.
Yes, right.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, propaganda is not a new thing. It didn't originate, in the World Wars of the 1900s. This was an ancient thing. You read the hieroglyphs on the Egyptian monuments. Well, you're just reading propaganda. I mean, they're just boasting. This is nothing but one long boast about this pharaoh did this great thing and this pharaoh did that great thing. They don't record defeats, in other words. They record victories. And so,
you know, it's propaganda when it's like he captured 47 cities and also added 37,000 stars to the sky. And you're like, I feel like, I don't know if this is like an accurate history.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see later on in this chapter how he's bragging about he's like, basically emptied the waters of the Nile. You know, he destroyed the heights of the cedars of Lebanon. It's just one brag after another, basically, is what you're looking at here. So typical arrogant hyperbole that you read in the Assyrian records. So anyway, but of course it is factual. He did come and he attacked. He attacked a lot of cities. And we're gonna hear about one of them in just a minute, Lachish. I'll describe a little bit in more detail about what happened there. But verse 14 introduces us to a little bit different side of Hezekiah. So we have this glowing report of Hezekiah. No king like him before, no king like him afterward. He followed the Lord with all his heart. He was like David, so on and so forth. All of which is true. I mean, we don't want to take away from that. But keep in mind that despite this very glowing complimentary speech about Hezekiah, it wasn't like he was perfect. So I mean, we're not about like some sort of superhuman, uber righteous, perfectly moral king. I mean, he's compared to David, and we know about David, right? David was a man after God's own heart, but David was also a guy who was after Bathsheba and who was guilty of murder and did a lot of bad stuff. So don't get the picture of that this David-like Hezekiah is going to be some sort of Jesus figure or something. He's not. He's got foibles and flaws just like all the kings did.
That's what makes the Bible different than the history of the Assyrians or whatever, is that they would have left this out, right?
Yeah,
they leave all that kind of stuff out. They're not going to tell you about that stuff. But
the scripture's
not like that. Maybe the numbers are rounded off and that kind of stuff, but they don't hide the failings of kings or leaders or heroes.
Yeah, you're not gonna be like looking at this big obelisk in Assyria that archaeologists might find, and you know when they're deciphering the Akkadian, they're like, oh, look, it says that in the fifth year of Sennacherib, he was on the roof of his palace.
Yeah,
and he saw. He saw this naked woman bathing and he wanted her, so he took her and then he killed her. Then he killed her husband. No, none of that's going to be recorded, but it is in the Bible because the Bible is not your typical religious propaganda. I mean, this just kind of puts it all out there. It opens a closet door. All the skeletons fall out for all the world to see. So what are we talking about here? Well, verse 14 says Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish, saying, now you might think he'd say something like, the Lord my God will destroy you, or how dare you enter into the sacred holy land of Judea and attack our cities. Nope. He says, this is Hezekiah talking to the king of Assyria. I have done wrong. Withdraw from me. Whatever you impose on me, I will bear. So things weren't good with Hezekiah. He's threatened by the Assyrian king, and he realizes probably because of what was happening at Lachish, he's realizing that from his perspective, he has no hope of winning a battle against the Assyrian king. So what's he going to do? Well, he's basically going to say, hey, sorry, I shouldn't have rebelled against you. Name the price and I'll give it to you. Whatever it takes for you to get out of my country, I'll pay whatever steep fine that you impose upon me. And we read the king of Assyria required of Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. So that's the price. At least that's the initial price. As we're going to find out just in a minute, the Assyrian king wanted even more.
By the way, that is a lot.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Keep in mind, by the way, that we're used to thinking of talents. Well, any time we hear about gold and silver, we're thinking of coins, right?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
That's the way that we ordinarily think about it. But they didn't have coins yet. This is not coinage we're talking about here. So this is weights. Yeah, this is how this was determined. So a talent in Hebrew is a kikar. And this was probably like weights. Maybe they were shaped like coins, disc-shaped. But we're talking about a talent that is 75 pounds.
Yeah.
So 300 talents. So 300 times 75 pounds of silver. And then 30 of these talents of gold. So get your scales out. Get your industrial size scales out here and just start measuring the gold. There's a whole lot of it.
I mean, it's over 20,000 pounds of silver.
Yeah, I mean, that's almost as much as I have hidden in my my back room there.
Right? I mean,
Fort Knox.
Yeah, 20,000, it was 22,000 pounds of silver. And then, 30, you're talking about, 2,200 pounds of gold.
It's a lot of precious metal. Yeah. And that's a steep price to pay. Now, the question is, all right, well, it's a lot of gold and silver. Where in the world are you going to get that much gold and silver from? Where are you going to get it from? The two places that we always hear about, from the king's house and from the Lord's house. Those are kind of your two national banks of Israel, if you will. And that's what we hear in verse 15 that Hezekiah did. Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the temple, in the house of the Lord, and in the treasuries of the king's house. So that's the silver. He's taking it from the two national banks, the Lord's house and his house. Where's he going to get the gold? Well, verse 16 says that Hezekiah stripped the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord and from the doorpost that Hezekiah had overlaid, and he gave all this to the king of Assyria.
Yeah, so they don't have this just lying around. They had to go, this isn't just like, everyone hand in your jewelry. This is like, they're popping gold caps off teeth. They are undoing the hinges on the doors. They're taking the doorknobs off. They're like, anything that's remotely got gold on it's got to go with it. Like, we're trying to get a lot of gold here. So if there's any, you have something in your house, Lord's house, king's house, is decorated with gold, it's got to come off.
Yeah, hand it over. Yeah, it's really a sad episode because it shows that it's a contrast. So later we're going to hear about how Hezekiah actually goes to the temple and prays there. He's asking God to intervene. But this time he doesn't do that. He goes to the temple not with the purpose of praying, but he goes to the temple with the purpose of looking around and be like, "Hey, is that gold up there? We'll strip it down. Is that gold there? We'll tear it off because we got to have all this gold. Otherwise, the Assyrian king is going to is going to be unhappy or more unhappy with us than he already is. So that it was a politically calculated decision that Hezekiah made. He's the underdog, and so he thinks there's no way that he's going to be able to defeat the Assyrians. And so what he turns to is the same thing that kings have turned to over and over and over. Well, you know, if you can't beat a guy, then you pay him off, more or less. And that's so that's what he's doing. So he does this. He sends it to the king, sends it to the king of Assyria. Verse 7. Now, you would think, I mean, I would think if I was just reading through this, that the Assyrian king would like kind of smugly receive this gift and be like, well, that'll teach him a lesson. And then, you know, pocket the money and then be about his business. That's not what happened. For whatever reason, we're not told. For whatever reason, this was not enough. So the payoff was not going to satisfy Sennacherib. Instead, he wants to go to Jerusalem itself. He wants to take the city. Whatever it takes, he wants to make sure that he walks triumphant through the gates of Jerusalem. And what he's going to do there, well, who knows? You can probably guess from what they did to other places. But anyway, what happens in verse 17 is that he didn't come himself, but he sends his top dogs. So in this translated various sorts of ways. The Hebrew is just rendered into English, is just transliterated, and sometimes it's translated. But what we're looking at here are three different titles, basically. So the ESV has the king of Assyria sent the Tartan, the Rabsaris, and the Rabshakeh, or however you want to say it in English. So these are three offices, we might call them, that were, representative of various kinds of authority. So NIV has the supreme commander, his chief officer, and his field commander. Robert Alter recommends that we translate this. He sent the vizier, the head eunuch, and the head steward. It doesn't really matter. These guys, in other words, these aren't personal names. These are the offices that they held. So Tartan and Rabsaris and Rabshakeh. So he sends these three guys with a great army from Lachish to King Hezekiah at Jerusalem. Now, what's happening at Lachish? Well, a lot of really horrific things are happening at Lachish. And we know this from a huge wall relief in the palace at Nineveh that belonged to King Sennacherib. So when you're not listening to the podcast, Google the siege of Lachish and just look at the images that are going to come up there. The whole battle scene is depicted in this massive wall relief. So you can see the Assyrians, they have these pointy hats, and some of them have slings. Some of them have, a lot of them have bows. Some of them have spears and shields. Some of these guys are in like these siege works. It kind of looks like a wagon or a chariot with a cover over the top of it and a ram in the front to, of course, to hit the walls. In the archaeological digs that they've done at Lachish, they found a huge siege ramp that the Assyrians built that went up to the city wall. There's pictures of Judeans, of the Israelites that have been impaled on poles or on stakes. There's also pictures of some of them being led away as prisoners of war. So this whole battle scene is depicted that was happening at Lachish, which is about 25 or 30 miles from Jerusalem. It was an important defense city. Like you had to get through Lachish to get to Jerusalem, basically. And so that's why it was attacked. So sometimes when you have a few minutes, Google the siege of Lachish, and you can read all about what was happening there, and you can see all the various images. I think they're in the whole thing is in the British Museum now. If you ever have a chance to go check it out, but it's a great archaeological remain that illustrates in this very graphic, violent detail everything that was happening at this biblical city. Now, none of this is described in the scriptures. We're just told that they were at Lachish. The whole siege and the battle and everything is not described, but we know that is what was happening at this time. So anyway, these guys come from that city, which has been conquered, And now they're on their way to Jerusalem. They show up to Jerusalem. These three guys, these three representatives of the king of Assyria, they come to King Hezekiah, and they go up at a place that's called, they stand by the conduit of the upper pool, which is on the highway to the washer's field. Now, we've heard about this before, or if you've read Isaiah, you've heard about this before. This is the exact same place where Isaiah confronts Hezekiah's father Ahaz and tells him, you know, here's your choice. Trust in the Lord or you're going to be destroyed. And Ahaz is like, oh, no, I'm not going to trust in the Lord. I'm not going to put the Lord to the test by asking for a sign. That's the same place where that whole episode occurred. Well, now we're back at this exact same place. And what's more, it's going to be a moment of who you're going to trust. You're going to trust in the Lord. You're going to trust in somebody else. So these three Assyrian officials show up. They're standing there and they called for the king. And so the king sends his own representatives out. So we have a little powwow here between the Assyrian officials sent by Sennacherib and the Jewish officials, the Israelite officials sent by Hezekiah. And these guys are named Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, and he's over the household. And then you have Shebna, who is the scribe or the secretary. Then you have a guy named Joah, the son of Asaph, and he's the recorder. So you got three Assyrian officials, you got three Israelite officials, and they're meeting there, and they're about to have this discussion.
This is interesting too. Like you send out three guys, and you would think you'd send out like the general, the captain, and the lieutenant or something. I don't know. He sends out his butler, his scribe, and his historian.
Yeah. I wonder if maybe part of the reason I'm this is totally conjecture, is because he expected these guys, these Assyrians, to speak in Aramaic. Okay, yeah. So Aramaic would have been the lingua franca of the day. It was kind of the what English has become, what Latin once was, what French sort of was for a while. I mean, that was just like that was a language that the educated people knew, and a language would have been the language of political discourse. And so, you know, who knows Aramaic in Jerusalem? Well, it probably would have been like the king's close officials, maybe not the generals, but maybe, you know, guys like, well, these fellas, you know, his secretary.
Scribe and the historian. I mean, they probably.
Yeah, they're gonna know Aramaic, yeah. Now, it backfires, though, because, as we'll hear in the course of this speech, when I don't know how to say his name, Rabshakeh, it can be pronounced different ways in English, but Rabshakeh. So when he starts talking, he doesn't speak in Aramaic. He speaks in Hebrew. They didn't expect that. I mean, they were thinking this was going to be like, you speak Aramaic to us, we'll speak Aramaic back to you. That way, you know, not everybody's going to be able to understand what's going on. Although, no, that would have destroyed the whole purpose of this. It's pretty actually a smartly political speech that this Assyrian guy is about to deliver, as we will hear momentarily. So he's going to speak in Hebrew so that, and he's going to speak no doubt with a loud voice, so that everybody who's hanging on the walls and trying to eavesdrop on this conversation so they can understand. So here's how he starts out. So this is Rabshakeh, the Assyrian. He says, say to Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, on what do you rest this trust of yours? Do you think that mere words are strategy and power for war? In whom do you now trust that you have rebelled against me? Behold, you're trusting in now in Egypt, that broken reed of a staff that will pierce the hand of any man who leans on it. Such is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who trust in him. The speech goes on. Let me pause there for just a minute. Noticed how often already the language of trust has come up. One, two, three, four, five. I count five, perhaps more times, just in the next few verses where that comes up. So that's what this is all about. Who are you going to trust in? And as what he's going to really be toying with is, you're going to trust in Hezekiah. You're going to trust in Egypt. You're going to trust in the Lord. Who are you going to trust in? really what he's wanting him to do is, of course, to trust in Sennacherib, the Assyrians. It's where he wants him to put their faith. And he's saying, you look anywhere else, you look to the gods of the nations, you look to your own God, you look to Hezekiah, you look to the Egyptians. Nowhere else are you going to find the kind of deliverance that you can find in the Assyrian king. You should fear, love, and trust in him alone is kind of the implication of this speech.
Yeah, and the language here is like pretty colorful, right? I mean, we're talking about Egypt and, you know, the Pharaoh of Egypt, you know, you don't want to trust in him. He's like a broken reed of a staff, which will pierce the hand of any man that leans on it. Like, I mean, this is, it seems like maybe this was like the one, if you're not talking about gods, if you're talking about other people that you might trust in, this is like, well, hey, whatever you do, don't make that mistake that some other people made when they decide to go try to team up with the Egyptians. Don't do that. That never works out.
Yeah, I mean, we do know from the Assyrian records that the Egyptians had rebelled against them. They'd formed a coalition with the Philistines to try and fight against the Assyrians, and they'd already been defeated. So he said, hey, you want to trust in the Egyptians? We've already kicked their butt. They're not going to be any help to you. It's like leaning on a broken reed that's going to puncture your hand. So you've got nowhere to go is basically his message so far. Now, I love how he shifts in verse 22. Man, this is some this is politics, political rhetoric, and misguided theology all kind of woven together here. He goes on. But if you say to me, we trust in the Lord our God, is it not he whose high places and altars Hezekiah has removed, saying to Judah and to Jerusalem, you shall worship before this altar in Jerusalem? So see what he's done. He knows a lot. He must have known, you know, he has his sources of information, spies or whoever. So he knows what Hezekiah has done. He's the guy that removed the high places.
Yeah.
You know, which from God's perspective was great. Now he's kind of, I think what his goal is, he knows that not everyone would have been happy with the fact that Hezekiah took away those high places. I mean, there would have been people who, you know, thought high places were great. And so now he's saying, yeah, well, you know, those were God's high places. And now he's taking those away. Do you really think that God is going to be pleased with Hezekiah because he's taken away these high places?
Yeah, of course the answer is yes. But this guy doesn't understand that those were... this is interesting because it seems that in his mind, he's like, oh, all of these high places were places where you could go and worship the God that the Israelites, the God of Israel. This is where you can do that. And what Hezekiah has done is got rid of them all and says, you have to make this trek to Jerusalem. You have to do it here in this one central location. Surely there's people that aren't happy about that. So he's sort of ignorant of the fact that those weren't high places to the God of Israel and that you were only ever supposed to worship God in one place. He doesn't understand all this. He thinks Hezekiah is making some kind of power move with the people. It seems like that maybe is not a popular move.
Yeah. Well, he's got his theology wrong. He's politically, he's skilled. He knows where he's coming from politically. He's got his theology wrong, but he's at the same time trying to manipulate the situation to make those who maybe are not fully on board with Hezekiah's decision to doubt whether what Hezekiah did was actually the right thing to do. So, he goes on with his speech in verse 23. Come now, make a wager with my master, the king of Assyria. I will give you 2,000 horses if you are able on your part to set riders on them. How then can you repulse a single captain among the least of my master's servants when you trust in Egypt for chariots and for horsemen? Moreover, is it without the Lord that I have come up against this place to destroy it? The Lord said to me, go up against this land and destroy it. And he didn't quite know when to stop. I mean, he's talking about don't trust in Egypt. Well, it's true when it comes to that. Don't trust in Egypt. But then he starts going astray when he claims that God is unhappy because Hezekiah has removed all his high places. And then he basically says, listen, I'm so great. I'd give you 2,000 horses, but you don't even have enough people to place his riders on these horses. You're weak, in other words.
This is a pretty big burn. Like, all right, how about this? I'll make a wager with Master. Let's do a test here. I'll give you 2,000 horses for this upcoming battle. And here's the bet. You don't have enough riders for them. I can spare 2,000 horses, but you couldn't fill them with riders if you wanted to. It's a pretty big burn.
Yeah, we'll try and make this a fair fight. We got these 2,000 extra spare horses. We'll just give them to you. You know, kind of even things up a little bit. The problem is, of course, you don't have enough riders to place on those. So it's not going to do you any good.
It's like if you said to someone you're fighting with, tell you what, we'll give you 50 bomber jets. Too bad you don't have any pilots or bombs.
Yeah, that's right. So, but my favorite part is when it gets to the very end, where he claims Yahweh's authority.
Yeah.
To come up against this place. He says, is it without the Lord? That's Yahweh, all caps, Lord. Moreover, is it without Yahweh that I've come up against this place to destroy it? The Lord said to me, go up against this land and destroy it.
Yeah, so here he's saying, your God told me he was angry with this removal of the high places and told me to go come and punish you for it.
Yeah. I mean, he's trying every trick that he can come up with in order to destroy the confidence of the people. Now, it's at this point when the Israelites are out there, Eliakim and Shebna and Joah, they say to Rabshakeh, please speak to your servants in Aramaic, for we understand it. Do not speak to us in the language of Judah. So don't speak to us in Hebrew within the hearing of the people who are on the wall.
That's the whole point, I think.
That is the whole point, yeah. In fact, that's what he goes on to say. He said to them, Rabshakeh says to them, has my master sent me to speak these words to your master and to you and not to the men sitting in the wall? And at this point, you kind of picture him like lifting his head up and spreading his hands out and pointing at all these guys who are on the wall like, hey, I'm not talking to you three. I'm talking to all these guys that I can see up there with their spears and their stones and their bows that are listening to our conversation. But then he wraps it up with this way. And not to the men sitting on the wall who are doomed with you to eat their own dung and to drink their own urine.
Yeah. This is him saying, I'm not here just to talk to you. I'm here to talk to everyone, maybe especially to all the guys that are definitely going to die if you don't do what you know you need to do. And then he does this, eat their own dung, drink their own urine. This isn't a bad intimidation move. If you're just some guy, you know, you're up there, you got your bow and stuff, and you have to imagine that this guy is saying this in a language you can understand, but he must be really projecting.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
So the idea here is that they're not whispering. He's like delivering a sermon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is a politically calculated speech that is supposed to produce terror or at least anxiety in the hearts of everybody who hears it. And I mean, keep in mind, too, this was people knew what happened during sieges. Mm-hmm. Everybody in the ancient world knew the horrors of sieges. I mean, in past episodes, we've talked about that terrible time when the city was reduced to, they were eating donkey brains and they were eating the dung of pigeons. And you have reports of people resorting to cannibalism. I mean, so everybody knew that things got really grotesquely, inhumanely horrible during sieges. So the idea of drinking your own urine, eating your own dung, this wouldn't have been just kind of like rhetorical overkill. This would be like, yeah, we've heard about these horrible situations. And of course, they probably knew about what had happened at Lachish. Reports had already come in that city had been taken. And there have been massive killings. In fact, archaeologists found one massive grave with like 1,500 skeletons in it there at Lachish. So it'd been a massacre. You're sitting on the city wall. You're listening to this. Your family, no doubt, is within the walls. And yeah, I mean, it's a time where you're struggling with fear, anxiety, doubt. And along comes this guy, and his mouth becomes the mouth of Satan, more or less, in order to get you to doubt whether you should believe the word of God and to get you to doubt whether you should trust in him. And so this whole speech toward the wall on the part of this Assyrian official is intended to undermine people's faith in Yahweh and his promise to Jerusalem. And yeah, he's not done yet. We'll have to finish it up in the next episode.
Yeah, yeah. He's trying to, at the very least, make it to where it's going to be very difficult for anyone to sort of rally the troops here. I mean, he's just spreading fear, and I mean, he's lying about certain things as well, of course, but he's trying to cover everything. He's like, we're going to kill you. God's on my side. We got more. You don't have enough men. If I gave you horses, you still couldn't fight me. Like, he's doing all the things. So he's making you question, you know, things theologically. He's making you question things strategically, and you're looking at the numbers. Like, I mean, he's trying to paint a picture that says any way that Hezekiah might try to spin this, you lose.
Yeah.
So don't listen to him.
right. Yeah, but, and he's going to continue that in the next few verses, which we'll get to in the next episode.
All right. Well, that is it. We are out of time. We will see how this thing shakes out. We're going to hear some more from these guys, and then we'll see who trusts and what coming up next episode. I'll see you then, Chad.
All right, see you then.